looking at a beautiful, clear lake with a mountain reflected in it. But one pebble dropped in and you realize, wow, it was only a reflection, you know? And if you can somehow imagine that happening with your experience of this world right now, imagine if all of this suddenly were revealed to be a kind of reflection on water, and that there's another level of reality. It's actually an appearance. And there is a kind of level of reality, or perhaps we better say level of consciousness or awareness of something, you know, in which it all arises. And you can find that. And when you do, it gives you this much different and sort of broader perspective on your life.
Imagine a stream. There's a bunch of logs in the way. All you got to do is take those logs out and then the stream flows. That's all you have to do. You don't have to create grief. There's just grief inside of you that's blocking the flow. So you just have to take an inventory and actually be able to see what's going on. And it's extremely difficult to see what's going on. That's why we have certain practices. All you got to do is remove those and automatically the water flows.
This episode is one of the first in a series of special segments from some of our episodes about the topics of career, parenting, and spirituality. The purpose of this podcast from the beginning has always been to bring you the wisdom of mentors to be able to help you learn from their journeys and their mindset and their perspectives and their purpose to be able to create a better life for yourself. So this series is yet another tool for you in that exact same direction. So get ready, listen in, take some notes, and identify for yourself, what do you want to change in your life in order to make your life even better for you? Let's begin. Here's Jai Kith from episode 3.
So basically, when you're going through intense disciplines, you kind of have like a fire burning inside of you. There's a constant upheaval, a constant flow of things coming up. After that, that's stopped. So it was like it's like you're out at sea with a giant storm, and then the storm's over and everything's calm. On the inside, over 2 years of every day, there was a giant storm. And then it all calmed down. There was no more storm. So everything cooled off. So I saw like a very long path into the future if I were to stay there versus leaving. If I were to stay there, it would have been like easy sailing and not as much growth as I personally would like versus leaving. That's why I left.
As in spiritual growth or something else?
Yes, correct. Spiritual growth.
Okay, so this is something that's often been on my mind. How much challenge do we actually need in our life in order to properly experience spiritual growth?
There's a balance and there's a personal preference. If you can, you know, there's no rush. You can take as long as you want. You don't got to do everything in this life, but I personally think that if you start like tasting the fruits of that, you'll kind of sort of consciously want to accelerate the process. But it's not needed, but it's really personal preference. There should be at least some, otherwise, you know, even if you didn't do anything at all, like the way life is set up, you're going to spiritually grow. It's just, you know, that's how it's set up. But that's like the slowest method. You know, let life kick you in the butt along the way. But yeah, it's definitely a balance. And that's why austere times were small periods of time. You know, I didn't do too much fasting, but I know some monks did, you know, certain types of fasting for you know, certain spiritual growth challenges. But it's something that was done in sort of moderation. Because if you do that too much, then like diminishing returns comes back through your effort, through spiritual practices, if that makes sense. I want to emphasize the power of that, not just like, oh, you know, I'm flowing with drive, the river, it's all good. It's seriously life-changing. Imagine every desire being instantly fulfilled times a million, all just like pumping through you. It's so, so amazing. You have access to that right now. Just saying.
What would you say to anyone listening who wants to gain access to it? What are the next three steps they've got to do that will move them closer to experiencing it right now?
Well, everyone's at different stages. Everyone's different. Different practices work for different people, et cetera, et cetera. But it is a personal journey and it is subjective. So nobody can tell you that you're doing it right or wrong. Only you can really know that. And it becomes objective to yourself, but objectively it's subjective. You know what I mean? like you can't just put it out on the table and everyone agrees that yes, you know, this is it. But like to yourself, it's you know.
So if someone's listening and they choose to sit down for a meditation, and who knows, maybe they've allowed 2 hours for this and they've just turned off their phone, they've just done 2 hours. Now, there's a particular question they can ask themselves. Of course, there are going to be a whole lots of things that come up. My personal experience of that, for example, is I remember my stomach started growling, and then I was thinking, what am I going to eat? And I imagined going down into the kitchen and there was going to be this wonderful food that I'd be able to eat, and I'd open the fridge door, and obviously there's not going to be any food there. And why isn't there food? Because I didn't remember to buy any. And obviously you didn't remember to buy anything because you're just an idiot. And see, you're an idiot. You're never going to be successful at anything. And then you bring yourself back to the couch and like, hang on, my stomach's just growled. What's going on? Where's this judgment coming from? But if there's a specific question that people are able to ask themselves and they manage to practice enough that they're able to be present for long enough to truly answer the question, what's the question that they should ask a friend of mine? What's that mantra?
Who am I?
Who am I?
Or what am I? What is I? Once you go to that, you're at the source of the river.
And if someone took that really simply and said, well, I am name, I am Eric, I am mm-hmm. Jennifer. Mm-hmm. And they're like, there you go, that's who I am. uh-huh. How would you challenge them?
If you're not that, then what are you? And just keep on asking yourself that. Anything that can be described, that your mind can conceptualize, your mind can put in a box, that you can label a name, is something that's not, it is so far beyond anything your mind can comprehend. It's the thing that's like the only thing your mind can comprehend. I don't have words to properly describe, but it's,
yeah, I'm asking you literally to describe the indescribable, right? Literally to put the words. So the one thing which you're saying is the way you find it is when you've got no words to describe it.
But you just keep on asking yourself. That's even a meditation. Keep on, you know, whatever answer your mind comes up with, you're not that. Then what are you? You keep going deeper and deeper. It could take years. But yeah, that's the source of the good stuff.
And here's James Kirby from episode 26. I was quite pleased to read quite a bit about meditation in your book and about your approach towards it. Do you want to share about how you use meditation as a tool to help people become more compassionate, or at least some of the links you found in research?
Yeah, there are many ways to kind of cultivate compassion. One is through sort of meditation or imagery. I mean, part of it is some people go in to do meditation very seriously. And so, like, they, you know, and part of it is because I need to get to this immediate outcome, you know, of being more Zen.
Yeah. I need to be more Zen. I need to have less thoughts. Stop thinking. Stop thinking. Wait, what? What's saying that? Stop thinking. Damn it. It's not working.
Exactly. Which is, of course, completely undermines
yes.
the whole process of meditation. But, you know, often meditation is used to help with our reactions to pain. And this is sometimes referred to as the sutra of the two arrows. So the first arrow is, of course, you know, the fact that as we are life, that life involves pain. So we've got that pain that's built in. The second arrow is then our reactions to that pain. So you can't shift the pain, but you can shift the way you start to relate to the pain. And meditation can be one way of helping that. And Jon Kabat-Zinn brought in this approach of meditation, specifically a form of meditation called mindfulness, to help with those with chronic pain. Because often when you have pain, your whole attention becomes very acute and focused on the pain, which then shuts down like engagement with everything else in life. As you're attending to the pain, and so your second arrow is then all the frustration and anger of not getting over the chronic pain because it's chronic. And so his idea was, well, we can work with that second arrow. We can't shift the chronic pain, but we can shift the way you're relating to your pain with mindfulness. And so part of engaging in mindfulness is not only recognizing that mindfulness is a process of coming back to the present moment. So it's always just trying to reconnect you back to what it is that's going on. So Thich Nhat Hanh would refer to mindfulness as a state of remembering, just remembering to come back. So the idea is remembering to come back, but as you're doing that, doing it with a friendliness to yourself, rather than, oh, God, I was drifting again. Why can't I do this? Which obviously just makes it worse. So a Buddhist monk, Matthew Ricard, in his book Altruism, kind of discusses mindfulness should never just be called mindfulness. It should be called caring mindfulness, because the way you want to do mindfulness is with this caring or compassionate gentleness, that when you notice the mind drift, you're able to bring it back with a friendly okay, and just bringing it back to the breath, a friendly inner tone, a friendly relating style to help you stay anchored in whatever it is that you are staying anchored on, which is often the breath.
Yeah, look, that makes perfect sense, and it does answer the question. Are those the key ways that you found that meditation helps people become more compassionate, or are there, is there any other ways as well?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a way of coming into contact with the present moment. Now, meditation, there's lots of different forms of meditation. One aspect of meditation is becoming more familiar with your mind. And so mindfulness can help with that, becoming more familiar with where my mind drifts to, where it goes to, kind of what are the natural patterns of my mind state. So it's becoming more familiar with your mind. And then the second part of meditation is you can then on purpose start to choose a certain mind to cultivate. And one mind that you could choose to cultivate is a compassionate mind. So if you're going to create this sort of compassionate mind, the idea is then sort of focusing in on this idea of how can I be sensitive to suffering and self and others, and then have this kind of a commitment to try and alleviate and prevent it. Now, that's a bit of a mouthful, so we sometimes distill it to how can I be helpful rather than hurtful or harmful. So in that kind of more distilled kind of connecting to the mantra.
And here's Henry Shukman from episode 27. What is meditation? What is mindfulness? What's the difference? And you shared that you've explored a whole lot of different meditation practices and spiritual practices. How does the meditation practice which you teach and guide people through now and practice for yourself differ to a lot of the other ones which you've explored? And why is that the one which you've landed on and connected with? Let's go to that first, and then we can explore where someone might apply meditation in their life.
Okay, so just a little bit of sort of a vocabulary, really. meditation is a thing that we do, you know, and it's usually about sitting down, although you can also do walking meditation, and paying attention in particular ways. And most of them are designed to develop mindfulness. So, because the word mindfulness often gets used kind of interchangeably with meditation these days.
Yes.
It's not, I don't think it's strictly sort of right, really. Mindfulness is what we're going for. We're trying to develop a kind of awareness that is broader than our sort of object-focused attention that we're normally in. You know, normally whether it's a task or a person or a thought or a project or something, we normally sort of we guide our attention in a narrow beam, usually, right? So it can be much wider. We're equipped with, in fact, a much wider lens all the time that's available. And we can, to get more flexibility, sort of zooming in when needed, being wider when needed. It's really nice because when we're in the broader awareness, there's an ease that always comes with it. Suddenly it's easier to recognize that we're alive, that we're experiencing this moment, that there's a lot of richness in this moment. You know, and that's really that's a real sort of loose way of defining mindfulness. That it's having that broader awareness, that recognition, oh yes, I'm having experience right now. I'm conscious right now. Experience is going on right now. Rather than just being kind of caught in just a chain of narrow objects that we just follow through the day, we never get that moment to recognize, I'm alive. You know, so I would, that's a very, one real sort of broad brushstroke way of saying that's what mindfulness is developing that capacity to be more broadly aware. Okay, so...
It might be, and so before we go to your next point, which I'm on edge to hear, it might be worthwhile for the listeners to then clarify as well, what's object focus? Because most people aren't necessarily thinking about things in their physical world, but they might certainly be thinking of thoughts. I think it was Josh Corder shared that you have 4,000 thoughts per minute on average. And obviously you're not aware of most of them, but when you're lost focusing on the thoughts, is that also what you mean by object focus?
Yes. Yes, it is. Yeah. I don't mean just physical objects. Thank you for bringing that up. You know, in the meditation world, objects can mean thoughts, even feelings as well, as much as it can mean physical objects. So dead right. Exactly. And sensations, of course, as well in the body. Would also be objects. Of course, it goes without saying. But so yes, and a lot of us have a kind of back and forth between tasks that we're engaged in, and then when we're not engaged in them, internal storytelling, narrative. You know, literally having voices speak in our mind. That are sort of, that's the internal monologue. The internal, sometimes it's dialogue. Just a running commentary on life, that if we're not used to noticing it, we might say, no, I don't. But actually, most of us do, but usually less so when we're engaged in a task. And so, you know, that's one reason that we can actually enjoy work, you know, is that it's, and of course, we can enjoy it quite a lot, and sometimes we don't, but one aspect of it is that it tends to switch off that internal self-monitoring and internal commentary, which really comes between us and our experience of life. And so to have a practice, and this is one thing meditation can do, is a practice that dials down the inner voice, the inner dialogue, the inner monologue. So it gives us relief from it, you know, at times at least. And having those moments when it goes quiet can be just remarkably lovely and allows us again to be more alive and awake to the moment at hand.
Here's Dina Kaplan from episode 28.
I mean, I think part of our journey, and Jack Kornfield talks about this, he gave a wonderful speech at Stanford years ago where he talked about how we should have a curriculum of the heart. I think a lot of the issues that we have, whether it's interpersonal, you with a friend, a family member, colleague, whatever that is, a lot of the tough things in relationships are about us either not being able to be with our own difficult emotions or thoughts, or not being able to be with somebody else's difficult emotions and thoughts. And part of the mindfulness journey is about opening your ability, expanding your ability to be with your own tough emotions and to be with someone else's. And what a gift to yourself and others to have that ability.
Well, that's a really important point. I'm sure you've seen, right? You've been teaching meditation for ages now. What we've been finding, I'm curious if you're finding the exact same thing. I'm sure you are. We find that as soon as people start meditating in the right way, they start noticing what comes up. They start noticing it in the moment, and then they don't feel like they have to react to it immediately. They see something, which maybe it's what someone else has done, which has triggered them, and usually that's unconscious. And then they take that in, they go, oh, hang on, I'm just noticing that I've got some resistance to this right now. And then even without having to do anything about it, it means that they don't react. It means that they don't escalate the conflict. It means that usually the conflict kind of just dissipates, but at the very least, it doesn't get worse. I'm guessing you found the same thing, right?
Yeah, it's everything. I actually have even coined that. I would call that pause there the gap. That's my own language, but you can feel free to practice that in your life. And I think it's a skill and an incredible tool to be able to bring awareness to the gap and to pause in that gap. And from there, you can choose how you want to respond to something. There's something else that I'm going to start writing about. This will be in the book, and I might write an article about it. But there's this state that we can get in when we're triggered. NPR did a wonderful segment on this, and they called it being hot. So it's not necessarily physically hot, right? But you're hot. I mean, you know it afterwards, at least, when you're triggered, whenever that trigger is. So you're in it. You are, in a way, I don't want to say you're going insane. That's not quite right. You have lost control over your ability to choose how you want to respond. So if we could find the gap, even when you're, quote, hot, or I'm going to call it swept up, swept away, even find your mindfulness, and I guess the Brits would say mind the gap. I don't know if there's too much Australian-British tension for me to bring up the British without that being triggering, Harry, but if that's allowed. So if you can bring awareness to when you're swept up, swept away, that's going to open up a lot more avenues to freedom for you.
Yeah, it's in that very moment, right? I find a lot of people making the mistake with meditation and mindfulness is that they think that they can practice their meditation once a day and that's it. It's almost like that's why they'll say, yeah, my yoga is my meditation, my run is my meditation. It's like, yeah, well, you can do that. You know, you can live life perfectly for 1 hour in your day, or peacefully for 1 hour, and then you can do the next 23 hours living life the complete opposite way, right?
I don't agree with that, actually, because I don't know if you're coming from the Vedic side or the mantra meditation, TM, call it whatever you would like, that in that world where the wisdom is coming from the Vedas, from the Hindu world, the suggestion is usually to meditate for 20 minutes twice a day when you're starting, and then after you have your advanced mantras, you're meditating on mantra, and after you get your advanced mantras, it might be 23 minutes or 24 or something like that twice a day. In the Buddhist world, we're not so strict like that, and so we would say it's fine. In fact, in our meditation teacher training program, we would have people meditate for 25 minutes once a day. I think it's fine to meditate once a day, and it probably varies by person how much you need to be able to pause the gap or mind the gap, to use the British expression. Yeah. So I think it's fine. I'm fine with once a day, I think.
I agree with you about once a day. Once a day is fine, right? But that time which you're spending to practice is that you got to focus on what you're actually practicing. A lot of people, they use that moment as an escape from their life rather than using that moment as cultivating the skill to, as what you're saying, when you're getting hot or swept up, that you can pause at the gap, right? Like there's not much point. Like there you go, I'm quoting you. You're having fun. If your meditation practice is limiting the experience of peace that you're feeling just to the times that you're meditating, in that once a day, That's perfectly fine. But it's not influencing other areas of your life intentionally. As in, like, if it's not helping you bring more awareness to those moments where you're actually triggered throughout the day, then it, in many ways, it's limited to that part of your life, right?
I am not sure I agree with you. I mean, I'm open to having a conversation about this 1,000.
I love your thoughts.
From what I have experienced and from teaching a lot of teachers who are then out there teaching others, look, we know that meditation changes the brain, right?
Yes.
You know this. If you were to take a fMRI or an image of brain before someone starts meditating, and then let's say they do 9 minutes or more of mindfulness meditation every day for 2 months, the science has shown that your brain will literally look different. There'll be more gray matter in the prefrontal cortex at the front of the brain, which is helping you to regulate emotions. So certainly what I've experienced is, let's say I want to change a behavior. Let's say, and this is, we're getting into it here, Harry. So it used to be, I have a trigger around not being heard or people not thinking I'm important. I think it comes from this perception that my parents were busy when I was growing up, which of course they were, because they were raising me and working and raising my sister and involved in a lot of local organizations, etc. So if I were to go to a dry cleaner and ask for a dress to be dry cleaned, and they were to say Wednesday at 5, and I come Wednesday at 5, and they say they need another half an hour, I might flip out on them. Like, oh, did you not, maybe I needed it Wednesday at 5. Did you not listen to me that I needed it Wednesday at 5? Like, I don't understand. Am I not important enough for you to bring this dress? I mean, I would really lose it. I was kind of the definition of swept up. Once I started meditating, my brain, the way I just processed information and respond to people, changed enough that I didn't need to write a note on an index card that would say 5:05 is okay. Or be flexible when the waiter puts more tomatoes on, rather than leaving off the tomatoes in the sandwich that I just ordered. I wouldn't have to write a long note card like, please don't react negatively, don't freak out, don't get swept away. I literally changed.
Here's Rajan Shankara, episode 31. This notion of personal responsibility might be a lot to hear, but then what about like the power of meditation as a skill? Like what's the power of it for you?
Yeah. Well, it's a way of to reveal things to yourself, who you really are. I mean, that's the beauty of isolation of thought. I mean, you get to kind of empty some space and time in your schedule, reveal like what's really in there. And once you start to kind of cancel out ideas like apps on your phone, you kind of realize that these things there is no X, like they don't go away. It's like, okay, there's a problem in there. I can't even control my own mind. And meditation is just the gradual practice of controlling your own mind and revealing like the perfection of who you really are to yourself over time. And it's as simple as you want it to be, or it's as complicated as you want it to be. And myself, I'm a fan of complexity. And so I became a monk like to get really good at meditation. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to. Like, that's the best part about it. You don't have to. You can achieve anything you want to achieve with meditation in the comfort of your own home, with consistency and a good technique, I think.
What do you mean about the controlling your own mind? There's the gradual practice of controlling your own mind. What do you mean by that? What do you see your mind as opposed to what most people see?
Well, I see it as like a phone, really. And on a phone, take my wife's example. Don't tell her I said this, but on her phone, on any given day, you've got about, 20 to 30 apps left there. Like, and she's like, what's wrong with my phone? What's wrong with my computer? And it's like, let's start by just like swiping away every single window you've went through the past 2 weeks, because none of that stuff needs to be there anymore. And you do that on the computer, get rid of all the, there's maybe 50 tabs open. There should be a max amount of tabs on every browser. Like at work, we're not allowed to have 10. Like the apps, the software we use at work will not let us go past 10 tabs of clients. You can't have more than 10 tabs.
Is that intentional?
Yes. Yes, you're it's right. Intentional. So you don't build up the system, bog it all down, and have all this private information floating around. So we should treat our mind like a phone. We should clear the apps away and clean it up and have a beautiful, open, and clear landscape for potentiality and spontaneity. Because when we get good at meditation, like when we get consistent and we kind of get past trauma, we get past like discomfort during sitting, and we get past the ability to breathe for more than 4 seconds, we start to have like this open field of nothing. Mm-hmm. And that's like when meditation actually begins. That's when we can actually start a real practice of meditation. And then what comes from that emptiness is like the bits of debris and specks that come off our spirit. And what, like if you had a ray of sunlight, right, there's different densities of the ray coming from pure sun to like just warmth that we feel on our skin. And we're getting closer to the sun in meditation. We're getting closer to that metaphorical sun or that metaphorical like person inside of us that guides and controls this body and thoughts and everything. And that's all it is. And so we want to kind of swipe away at those thoughts and those experiences in our mind, like our phone, like the apps on our phone. And that's enough for like a few years, because that is very difficult. We've had those apps open for a long time, maybe 20, 30 years. And it's time to swipe those closed. And that doesn't happen overnight, but that's all we're really doing.
And how does that differ to cold showers, for example? Anyone who's listening to this is taking a cold shower, they know that when they're exposed to the cold, there is nothing else that they end up thinking about except for the cold, right? That's all they can think about because they're in freezing cold. Like it clears everything out, at least until you get back out and warm up again, and it'll come sliding back, right?
Now, I'm a fan of cold showers. I'm a fan of techniques. I'm a fan of shock therapy. But at the end of the day, those prepare you to eventually sit down with yourself. Mm-hmm. And nothing will help you like paying attention to your own breathing and then using techniques to, once you actually sit down and alone with yourself. The shower is good, but it's not meditation. It's not real. And by real, I mean, it's not permanent.
Mm-hmm.
It's not permanent. It's fleeting. It's like you needed something to kind of get to a better state of mind, but the mind is better than that. The mind is a much better adversary than you think. Mm-hmm. And a cold shower it's like, that's not enough.
Here's Jai Kith in his second episode with us from episode 41.
Meditation is a transformative process, and it's an experiential process. And in the beginning, you know, we're so used to trying to avoid pain and going towards pleasure. And in meditation, we start shifting to welcoming pain. Now, that may sound strange. You know, why would you want to welcome pain? But, you know, you'll find that when inside, emotionally, when we have pain or any sort of suffering, if we want to try and fix it, if we want to try to push it away, if we want to try to avoid it, pretend it's not there, say it's bad, all of that fuels it even more. And so in meditation, you're actually going to be welcoming in all of your pain. And when you do that fully, that's when it transforms.
Right. And how long do you need to commit? We've been talking about consistency and making sure that we're making the most of what we're doing. What does it look like to be consistent with meditation, and how long until we start getting the results?
Yeah. In the monastery, we did an hour and a half a day. Don't worry, you don't have to do that much. I recommend 30 minutes, but you can literally start with 60 seconds. If you have a very busy life, you've never really done anything like this before, it's difficult for you to find time, et cetera, et cetera. Start with 60 seconds. Create a space for meditation, and every day show up for 60 seconds. And you'll find that maybe you want to stay for 3 minutes, you know, and then just make it go a little bit longer until it's the 30 minutes. Now, to see results, you know, that varies. The very first time you can do it, the very first time you do it, you can see results, or maybe it's a couple weeks down the road. You know, a lot of the results that we see may not be what we think the results should be, so we don't see them as actual results. but, you know, the process starts right away. And one thing I always try to emphasize is that you cannot, the way we approach meditation here, you cannot get it wrong. There is no possible way you can get this wrong. The only way you can get it wrong is if you do not show up.
Yes, you've spoken about that quite a few times, right? People are often trying to discipline themselves and judge themselves and go, no, you got to pay attention, or you got to welcome it, or you got to let go. Like they start really pressuring themselves and they're trying to discipline themselves. And the way that I've heard you share it in the past is the only way that we discipline, like the only discipline we need in this practice is to show up for practice. That's the discipline. So it's not like this is all without discipline and all nice and fluffy and rainbows and happy and whatever. We got to show up and actually do the work. But the work is not in the meditation. The work is showing up to the meditation, making the correct time in our busy schedules, so making the space.
It's a bit of a paradox that no effort is required in meditation. So you say, you know, your mind's, okay, well, you know, what do I do? How do I even get anything? you know, what's the purpose of all this? But the most difficult part of meditation is how incredibly simple it is. And so our minds want to participate. They want to, you know, move the wheels and try to get things moving and going. But anything that, any sort of effort like that just hampers things even more. But that's fine. You know, it's going to happen. It's supposed to come up. and so when you start having the actual experience of a release, when you actually start opening up and your pain goes away and gets replaced with your true inner joy, you're going to be like, oh, wow, okay. You know, for most people, when they start experiencing that in meditation, it doesn't seem like they did anything at all. It seems like it was done to them. But really what's happening is that we stop suppressing, we stop holding on. So then it goes all by itself. So really there's a lot of habitual effort that's holding our pain inside. And so meditation, you start gently unraveling that. But the release happens completely effortlessly. Any sort of effort is suppression.
So I hope you received a whole lot of value from engaging in that conversation. What were the key takeaways for you? What can you schedule in your life right now to make sure that the time you just invested into listening to this exceptional conversation with this amazing mentor and this amazing individual is time that wasn't misused, but was time that you've allocated properly to enhancing your life and improving it? Whatever it is, schedule it now, practice it now, be the successful person you're meant to be, live with purpose.